Your narration came in after you finished all the sound work, took the time to do the background sound.
Yeah, okay, so there's several different steps.
And then you went to the studio and then you spoke about...
There's several different steps. You collect all the sound and then you log it all. You know, you go through your tapes and write down what's where, you know, so you know at least what you have to work with. And then you can go through it and, you know, start writing up. First you write the lead, which I'll come to in a minute, you know, how you want to introduce the piece, and that's a good way to sort of get you thinking in the right mode. You know, then what do I want to come next? And you look at all your sound and sort of... People have different methods. Sometimes you can just write it on paper. Sometimes people put it on, you know, index cards, make up clotheslines and rearrange the order, you know, with clothespins. There's lots of different ways you could do it.
That's like a storyboard for film.
Yeah, you could. In fact, they had us do that even for radio, which sounds weird, but yeah, they had us, gave us storyboard, you know, paper, and you drew out, well, I want this, divided into scenes, you know, this is scene, and then, you know, this happens, and make a logical,
like the Conan O'Brien, you know, stick people thing.
Yeah, it was stick people, or whatever, however you want to do it, you know, and find a logical order for the piece to go in. Okay, so why did I play this whole thing? It's obviously a lot different from the type of reporting that, you know, most of you are probably going to be doing. You know, a lot of times you're all, you know, on deadline. You don't have, you know, 2 or 3 months to put something together. You know, you might have to put it together overnight or, you know, even in a few hours. And you want all this time to write scripts and revise them. And though you should really try to get feedback from other people, if not in the process of putting it together, at least when it gets on the air, you know, because I found that's really the best way that I've learned from hearing my own stuff, listening back to it, and then letting other people listen to it, and then listening to a lot of other radio myself, hearing, you know, interviewing other people, doing interviews, say, well, gee, that was really good. Well, what did I like about that, or what didn't I like about that? And then trying to incorporate the things I liked in my own interview style, hearing, you know, what I do and what other people do that doesn't seem to work, and then trying to change those things. So, yeah, even though this is obviously a lot different from a lot of what you all might be doing, you could certainly incorporate a lot of elements of this type of, you know, documentary style in a lot of average reports. And there's different ways, you know, as I discussed. Another thing that I didn't get into yet is you brought up is the lead at the very top, how to just draw people in initially. And I had a newspaper, yesterday's Washington Post, because a lot of these... you know, things I'm teaching you are transferable between all different mediums, whether it be television, whether it be radio, whether it be, you know, journalism, newspaper reporting, starting with writing a lead. You want to draw people in right away. Both, you know, in radio, there's sort of two different leads. There's the anchor lead that you usually write. So you do a report, and then you write up an anchor lead. So, you know, the host is going to introduce your piece somehow. So you need to write up some way for them to introduce it, to draw people in, make them interested, give them a reason to stay tuned. If they're arriving at their destination, you don't want them to turn off the car and get out. You want them to sit there in their driveway, you know, on the edge of their seat. You know, listen, there's this thing in public radio they call a driveway moment when people are just so captured and they just want to keep listening. So there's different things you want to sort of look at when, you know, you're writing your lead. And then there's sort of another lead, sort of like a lead, once you start the piece, you know, your initial statements before you really get into the piece, that also keeps people's attention. A lot of times, particularly with the hosts, the anchor lead, you want to sort of lead up to the brink without giving away all the details. So you want to sort of be, you know, you be brief, but, you know, give people just enough information to make them interested. You know, sometimes you could be sort of poetic or be sort of vague in a sort of mysterious way, but obviously don't be too flowery or anything. And I want to, you know, this is evident in, like I said, all different types of reporting. You just look at the average newspaper, you know, Washington Post. Okay, here's a story. Just look at, you know, it's a good practice to do, just to pick up any paper or anything. Look at the first sentence or first paragraph. Princeton, New Jersey. William Robertson wants Princeton University to give his money back, all $525 million of it. And the story goes on from there. Right there, I mean, you're interested. Here's a good one. One evening this summer, former diplomat Joseph Wilson sat amid the African-themed decor of his spacious Washington home, sipping a glass of beer and talking about a trip he took to Niger for the CIA. His wife, Valerie, was in the kitchen preparing chicken for a cookout and arranging red, white, and blue napkins. Suddenly, a giggling boy streaked naked into the living room and jumped into his father's lap. Bath time was nigh. Valerie Wilson rounded up the towel-headed three-year-old and his twin sister, efficiently taming the household whirlwind. Again, it sort of captured your attention. Now, not all leads are like this. I mean, sometimes it'll be, you know, a strict report, you know, angry Californians ousted unpopular Democratic Governor Gray Davis Tuesday and replaced him with Republican movie star and political novice Arnold Schwarzenegger. Just, you know, just the facts, ma'am. Or a for-profit healthcare company based in Nashville is negotiating to purchase Prince George's County's financially troubled hospital system. Well, that's just the facts. But, you know, there's different ways of reporting, and, you know, I encourage you all to try to be creative and find, you know, interesting ways to capture people in, like this. On a narrow road strung perilously along a rock ledge above the beach, Cornelio Gama stopped his Jeep and motioned to the spot where his rebel band had ambushed a column of three dozen Indonesian soldiers. I mean, right there, you know, you're like, well, what is that about? What, you know, what's with that? And you're interested. You want to hear more. So there's all different ways to write leads. There's a few different sort of formulas that people tend to use. And even though they use them all the time, it doesn't seem like they get old because there's all these different stories, and, you know, different details that people tell for each, you know, story that you have. One of the different formulas people tend to use is sort of an element of surprise. You know, it's sort of everything seems normal, but is it really? You know, there's this strange twist. Like, I'll play, you know, the beginning of the Tall Barney lead again, the anchor lead. And I actually didn't write this. We produced our pieces, like, self-contained, so she cut off, actually, the beginning of my piece, and they wrote their own lead. So this wasn't my doing, but you could hear how they started.
Tall Barney's in Jonesport is a lot like most other small-town restaurants in Maine. But Tall Barney's has something on the menu that distinguishes it from other eateries in the state, tall tales. At Tall Barney's, exaggerations and white lies are as common as scrambled eggs.
Okay, so you get the idea. It's very normal, but there's a strange twist, you know. So that's one formula. Another one is, you know, capturing people with, you know, or capture people in with the element of suspense, which is, I guess, sort of similar. People want to stay tuned to find out what will happen next, you know, like this the driveway moment I was saying. They don't want to leave the radio. And I'm going to play this other piece that I've done for FSRN a while ago, just the beginning of it, so you hear how it starts.
The question that I usually ask people is, you know, how were you picked up? And the answer in almost all of the cases is they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. Things such as, you know, asking a police officer for directions. You know, I had one client who did exactly that. He was lost in Newark, trying to locate an attorney, and sees a police officer, flags him. And the next thing you know is the immigration officer, instead of giving him directions, asking him what his immigration status is, and then, instead of giving him directions, give him a free ride to downtown, and now he's locked up, and he's spending his third month in Hudson County.
That's another thing when you're saying, you know, you hear what people say, or someone said that, you hear, you know, people saying something before you announce who they are, before you back announce them. That's another thing within a piece, even, you know, after you pass the lead. You know, you hear what someone says before you say, well, so-and-so says this, you know. So that's another way, you know. And this is, you know, this is the same model that we, you know, like, for example, Saturday Night Live, you know, traditionally starts with this cold opening. Before they do the opening of the show, they just have this skit, you know, so another way of capturing you in. Or, you know, on our show, we have teasers at the beginning of every show, they're called. So we just go through, you know, we have all the pieces for the show ahead of time. And we'll pick out little segments, you know, of the highlights of different pieces, and we string them all together at the beginning of the show to sort of give people a taste of what's to come. Once you're within a piece now,
Wait.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, anyone throw out any questions anytime.
Why do you need one?
Why do you need what?
Well, I mean, I'm like looking at all the stuff submitted from, like, you know, MetroWatch and the Radio Co-op and stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of them don't have leads.
So how do they start?
Could you just explain, like, what's the point of them?
Well, people need to be, in some way, sort of prepared for what they're going to hear, I think. And they don't, you know, like I said, you don't want to give away the whole story because otherwise people don't have any, you know, it's like giving away the ending of a book. I mean, people don't, why are they going to read it then? But you want to give people a little sort of taste or some kind of reason to stay tuned, I think. And so you need to you know, put a little bait out there. So, anyway, usually, you know, there's a host or someone, you know, I mean, there doesn't have to be a host, I mean, but that's a typical style of most radio shows. There's a host sort of introducing pieces. So just sort of for the continuity of the show, generally you want, you know, whoever the voice is to say something, sort of say, well, hey, we're having this piece now.
Well, I was going to say, there's a book called The Summer of 42, and I read this book in high school. And the way it started, I mean, like, I didn't want to read this book, because I don't want to read about the summer of 42. But the way it was led in, you know, they talked about New London or wherever this was at in World War II, and but how it was like the beaches, and you could feel the ocean, and you were kind of there. And so now, you know, like, I'm interested in the summer of 42 about these young boys and their experience with this woman. And the husband went off to war, and the guy lost his virginity.
I saw the movie.
You saw the movie? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was a pretty good book.
So you could, yeah, you could take a lot of times subjects that on the face of it wouldn't be all that interesting. You could find really interesting ways to portray them to the people. And the way to start with that is by just leading them in initially.
And that's what makes it novel.
Yeah. You know, if you don't capture people from the beginning, then they will have tuned out by the time it gets interesting, you know.
When you talk about leads, usually you're talking about longer pieces, 3 minutes or more. And just like with the articles that you're reading that have kind of like either straight news story leads or like kind of surprise twist leads, it leads into like a longer story. But what if you're dealing with like a short piece, like a 1 minute piece? Like in the Washington Post where they have the world in brief section, none of those like little clips have a lead, you know, it just kind of like tells the story as fast as it can. And sometimes if you're, you know, doing, you know, just the first 5 minutes of the hour and you're giving the news, you don't have time to give a lead to each piece.
Well, generally there's still, I mean, with radio at least, you know, even with headlines, if you do, you know, a headline for, you know, they call them spot pieces for any of the news, there's still, you know, some way that hosts will lead into, let me, I can find an example quickly of something I did. So they would have me, you know, I'd write my story, it would be like a 45-second, you know, spot or so, and then I'd write a lead for the anchor to read.
Some students at a New Brunswick high school protested when the valedictorian gave a commencement speech in English and Spanish. Scott Gurian has more from New Jersey.
So it's really brief, but it's something at least to sort of prepare people.
It's like almost like, they didn't do that, did they? Gave it in English and Spanish?
Yeah, I mean, you're not, obviously people aren't going to be that creative when it's just, you know.
But that's an anchor lead, though. That's not like your own lead.
Oh, not my own lead, no. Yeah, I mean, it's not really a lead once I start, but it's sort of, I mean, really a lead by its technical definition would be what the person would read to introduce it. But there's sort of a beginning of the piece, even, you know, if I go back to the Tall Barneys here. So, you know, she does her lead, Lies, Tall Tales Are as Common as Scrambled Eggs.
Documentary Studies in Portland.
By 6 in the morning, Tall Barneys is usually the busiest spot in town. A regular crowd of lobstermen and townsfolk sit around the long rectangular table in the center of the front room, where the clatter of silverware and dishes mix with stories, laughter, and lies. That's right, lies.
So,
over time...
So right there, it's a little bit of something. And it's not really a lead, but it sort of is, you know. So, and that's why a lot of times, you know, the way you start out in a report, basically you're sort of saying the same thing that the anchor said in the anchor lead. So that's when a thesaurus comes in handy. You just basically find different ways to say the same thing. A lot of times, you know, the anchor will be sort of vague in their description, then you give new details in what you're saying. So, you know, like today we ran sound on Peace Watch from the Project Censored Awards, where they give awards for journalists who uncover the most censored news stories. So I think Verna just said something, you know, well, actually, there was no piece. But if there was a piece, she would have just said, you know, well, there was these awards over the weekend. And then I would have started saying, well, this was the 27th annual Project Censored Awards. It's sponsored by Sonoma State, you know, University. And you could give all these further details, you know, new information. Oh, I think that's what I was trying to say way before, and I totally forgot. Yeah. As far as my piece, so I came back with all the sound of all these people. Just talking about, you know, how great the diner was. And I brought it back to everyone. And this is another element you try to, you know, put in pieces, well, why should we care? You know, so there's this great place to gather, you know, so what? So that's when I thought I had all the sound I needed, so then I had to go back another weekend, another 4 hours, and collect more sound. And, you know, I spoke to the people. I up till that point, I had just been speaking with them in this main room, And at that point, I took them one-on-one individually into the back room and interviewed them back there, which is a totally different dynamic. I really tried to get the sense of, well, how important is this place to you? What if it closed? And in fact, the diner was up for sale at that point. You know, this is really the only gathering place in that town. There's no other place like this. What would it mean, you know, if there wasn't a place like this, to really sort of, you know, narrow in on what's the importance of this and you know, try to convey that to people, that it's not just, oh, well, there's this place and so what, you know. So you try to convey that, yeah.
So when you do a piece, are you asking why is this important to the people involved, or why is this important to the people who are listening?
Both. I mean, certainly you obviously want to capture, you know, the people in your piece, whatever issue you're covering, you know, how does this affect them? And the best way to do that is, you know, to really capture stories. A lot of times, particularly with a lot of the reporting, you know, that people do around here, it's sort of very politically charged, both in the material and in the style. People, you know, it's very easy, I think, to get caught in a trap of just sort of getting either preachy or talking about these sort of vague and theoretical issues. And if you really find these stories about how are these issues affecting people and why is this important, you know, it just, there's always some kind of story that will illustrate this larger issue. And so why is it important to people? And then, you know, try to convey that to the listeners and try to really capture the gravity of the situation in the people that you speak to. Try to, you know, find the best people who are the most, you know, who this issue means the most to. And it's not always spokespeople, sometimes just, you know, people who it's affected by, you know, these issues affect, so.
If you notice his documentary, it was like a camera. He had a wide angle, and then he would have a focus, almost like a portrait. Then it'll be again a motion, and then a wide angle, and then a portrait. If you re-listen to it, you will actually almost hear what we see in cameras. And that's what they say, that the most effective thing is when people relay one on one. And then once they're hooked, then you bring the big issue or you play on that dynamic. And he did it. He did it with the
sound that you're speaking of. I mean, he narrowed in on one of the guys and he was speaking in this Celtic type, whatever, brogue that he had. That I kept hearing this clatter of the background.
Well, that's part of it.
So that was like the kind of like almost two scenes simultaneously.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. Also, in my own narration, mm-hmm. I mean, we'll hear a particular person's story, and then I would talk to give a sense of the broader picture, what mm-hmm. the place is like, you know, or give some other detail, lobster, you know, fishing pictures on the walls or something.
Blah, blah, blah.
I kind of just want to say, I guess something that I thought was interesting was how you kind of like chose not to include yourself in the story. Like,
yeah.
You never turned the camera towards yourself.
Yeah.
But kind of in a way, you did, because. Like, there are certain parts of it where you're telling it as though it's your own story, you know? Mm-hmm. You're like, Barney Beale is rumored to have stood over 7 feet tall and possessed extraordinary strength. And then you're, like, talking about this guy, and you're like, take Buddy Mills, for example. So it's like, you're one of the storytellers.
Yeah.
Like, you know him.
Very much sort of in the role of a storyteller.
So you take
yeah.
on the voice of the character.
Not, yeah. It's not like I'm a reporter as much as a storyteller and just, yeah. you know, this is what's going on, yeah.
Which fits with the story. So.
Yeah, yeah, it goes with the topic. I mean, yeah, obviously the way you're going to sort of narrate and, you know, present an issue is going to differ widely depending on what the issue is. So I wanted to play a report I had done for Free Speech Radio News to give you a sense of sort of this just storytelling. They actually had this whole series a few years ago. So it had been reported that, you know, the Bush administration was going to cut the budget to clean up all these toxic Superfund sites across the country. And so they had this five-part series, you know, each day, this one particular week, you know, they contacted different reporters around the country where there were Superfund sites whose budget was in danger of being cut and how this would affect the people there. So it's this sort of theoretical topic you hear on the news, and what does that mean? So I went to this town and spoke to these people there, and you'll hear the way I describe it, just sort of describing the story of what it's like, using, again, analogies, like I said, and trying to be rich in, you know, descriptions and so forth.
It's Tuesday evening, and 15 people are sitting in the living room of Tina Friedman's Marlboro, New Jersey townhouse. Around the circle are local environmentalists, town zoning board members, political representatives, and longtime residents. They're having a brainstorming session trying to understand how cuts to the Superfund budget will affect their community and what they can do about it.
So the cleanup goes into general tax revenues, and we then are all paying rather than responsible parties, I know.
Marlboro is home to two Superfund sites. At one of them, Burnt Fly Bog, community members say the contamination is so bad they can see the oil bubbling up from the ground on a hot day, kind of like they imagine the La Brea tar pits. Burnt Fly Bog is also polluted with elevated levels of polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. Despite its cleanup nearing 95% completion, the bog was recently placed on the list of toxic sites whose federal funding may be cut as the Superfund runs out. Less than 20 miles north of Marlboro is the abandoned site of Chemical Insecticide Corporation in Edison. Chemical Insecticide manufactured a variety of herbicides and defoliants, including Agent Orange, until the company went bankrupt in 1972. Now, the soil and groundwater are contaminated with high levels of arsenic and a variety of chemicals. One in four Americans lives within 4 miles of a Superfund site, but for the 77,000 people living within 4 miles of chemical insecticide, that's not a vague statistic, but rather a grim reality.
Well, you have residential areas to the left of us, residential areas to the right of us. You have a daycare center 200 feet from the site. You have a Metuchen Borough pool about less than a quarter mile from here. And you have a roll bakery that makes rolls for all the McDonald's in the tri-state area, just on the other side of the Superfund site.
Robert Spiegel is executive director of the Edison Wetlands Association, an environmental group created to monitor the cleanup. He's standing in front of the fenced-off entrance to Chemical Insecticide and pointing to a thin black polyethylene carpeting that's used to cap the contaminated soil. It's the same type of plastic sheeting used to cover swimming pools, he explains. Spiegel is concerned because the lifespan of the cap is 5 years, and it expired 2 years ago. This also worries people like Gail Horvath, whose backyard is located about 500 yards from the edge of the site. After waiting more than a decade for chemical insecticide to be decontaminated, she feels like she's waited long enough.
We were told that the project was going to be underway. We were finally seeing some progress. And now all of a sudden, it's getting a little tiring because, you know, it's like, what? You have to wait your turn. There's another site that's worse. There's another site that's worse. Well, you know, when does it become our turn already? And I just can't say it's just, you know, we want our site cleaned up. There are other sites. Clean them all up. We're all entitled to live in a safe place.
In response to recent controversy, EPA spokeswoman Stephanie Bell has claimed that the Bush administration is committed to cleaning up Superfund sites and that final funding decisions have not yet been reached. Whether the administration will change its mind on all or a portion of the money allocated has yet to be seen, she says. But according to Robert Spiegel, the EPA is obligated to fulfill its promise to clean up the chemical insecticide site.
With Superfund, there's what's called a record of decision, and that's a document that's signed by the EPA once they decide how they're going to clean up a site. And that is a legally binding document that requires them to do the cleanup. That was made last year. That was signed last year. You know, the EPA came in here and they made a promise to this community, just like they promised communities all through the United States, that they recognized that these sites were basically cancers in the neighborhood and they were going to come and take out these cancers. And now they're going back on their word. Now they're telling the American people that the profits of the chemical and the oil companies are more important than the health and welfare of the American people.
Spiegel's group, the Edison Wetlands Association, as well as the Township of Edison, are considering taking legal action against the EPA. Meanwhile, back at Tina Friedman's house, concerned community members are discussing ways to build a movement against the Superfund cuts. Some of them feel that New Jersey may well be the birthplace of a national movement to force the EPA not to abandon any of its sites.
And then I think there's also a conversation about maybe collectively working with other communities that are being affected by Superfund, get together and form some kind of group that we can go to Washington and really have our voice be heard.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Scott Gurian in Edison, New Jersey.
So, let's see, there's some other things I could play. I don't know how long we want to go. There's another thing. I was going to talk to people about working with sound and music. And you'll hear part of an example. This is another example I could play, but maybe I will. So you have sound, you know, or music or something in the back. When you're working with music, first of all, sometimes, you know, you'll want some music to accent your piece or something. you know, obviously, I mean, it's sort of a fine line. It takes a while to learn. You want it to sort of add to the piece, but not sort of overwhelm it. And part of that's just sort of in the mixing. You know, you don't want it too loud. You just sort of want it in the background, except maybe on occasion to highlight something, you could bring it up and then, you know, in between sentences or something, then bring it back down or something. But you also sort of want it to sort of add to the piece and move the piece along without drawing the attention too much to the music. And that's something it takes quite a while to practice. And the other thing I found is you don't want... Well, I mean, generally, you're going to use... When I'm talking music, I mean instrumental music. And generally... And this wouldn't be, obviously, usually a typical reporter piece. I mean, this is sort of more of a sort of longer-form documentary piece, generally, when you add in music. I found that usually you don't want something that's really recognizable because then people, you know, concentrate too much on the music and, well, why are they playing that or something. You just want something that'll sort of can be sort of background noise. And so it moves the piece along and it's in the background, and then whether it's music or whether it's ambient sound or something, and then if you pull it out, then suddenly the attention's drawn much more to what the person's going to say. So, you know, you can not only work by adding music but by taking it away. And you could use that to accent if someone's about to say something really important. And, you know, then suddenly, you know, if someone was tuned out or, you know, not really listening, then suddenly the music goes away and they're like, you know, they're startled. It's like if someone's sleeping, you know, like if they're in a light sleep, and even if you, like, put on the lights or turn them out even, or if there's a television on and then you turn the TV off, just by turning the TV off, you know, they'll hear a change in sound, and if someone's in a light sleep, they'll wake up or, you know, say, well, what just happened? So you could use that as a tool. This is a piece a friend of mine just did. He basically just went to this barber shop in Portland, Maine, and interviewed.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The Senior Citizens Barbershop in Portland, Maine, is a two-story brick building on Longfellow Square. The sign next to the door says, discounts to senior citizens, walk-ins welcome, hospital and house calls by appointment. Inside, the cash register has just three buttons labeled men's, boys, and senior. A haircut costs $7 for a man, $5 for children 12 years and younger, and $5 for seniors over the age of 62. The barber, Norman Millett, is tall with white hair and a red smock. He has run this shop for 41 years.
So many things, nothing surprises me anymore. It's about 2 years ago, this guy, old Sarge, came in for a haircut. And there was a lot of people waiting. Sat right there next to the sink. And he's snoring. People saying, boy, that guy's really comfortable. He says, yeah. Then after a while, there's a guy, Bernie, he was sitting two seats away. I usually go get him a coffee and a hamburger because he's got a slight stroke. So I go over and I say, I'll let old Sarge sleep for a few minutes and I come back. And the Army recruiter was here too. He says, Norman, I think we got a problem. I think he passed away. I says, you're kidding me. I says, geez, check him out. Maybe he's right. Nah. Then people are coming in and his eyes are shut and his mouth is shut. So I says, if we cover him, somebody's going to say, well, you get him covered. If he's dead, they wouldn't believe you. And if they believe you, they'd probably start screaming. So we just tell him he's sleeping. So after a while, people, when it got slow, only one in the chair and Bernie's eating his hamburger, the recruiter kept saying, no, you got to do something. Yeah, okay. So I called 911. They said, pull emergency. I says, I got a problem here. I got a guy that passed away. They get all shook up. Oh, you call, we got to get somebody else? No, we're not. I says, wait a minute. We got a slight pulse. Oh, okay, we'll be right up. There's a young guy that came in. He sat in between there, and he says, he's talking. He said, that guy needs a haircut. And I says, okay. We try to keep a low profile. Guy in the chair said, you got to tell him. Could hear the fire trucks coming. The recruiter's outside to wave him in. They pull up, and the guy says, look at that, a fire truck, an ambulance, and a police car? I says, oh, yeah. He said, they're pointing in here. I says, oh, yeah. I said, you know the guy you've been talking to? I said, he's been dead for about a half an hour. He says, why didn't you tell me that? And I said, you didn't ask me that. You asked me who's next.
This piece was produced by Carrie Seed. It's 22 minutes before the hour.
So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, questions, comments?
Yeah, keep up the good work.
Thank you. Yeah.